Hi, I'm Dawson Church, your host for the Tapping Peak Performance Series. I am so excited to share these breakthrough programs with you, and I look forward to powerful shifts in your level of personal performance as a result. By listening to this program, you agree to all the terms of the disclaimer, which you can find at disclaimer.eftuniverse.com. Now let's explore the next insightful topic in the series together. Dr. Joe Dispenza is a chiropractor and one of the principal teachers in the hit movie What the Bleep Do We Know? He studied biochemistry at Rutgers University and earned his chiropractic degree from Life University. His postgraduate study has been in neuroscience, brain chemistry, cell biology, memory formation, and longevity. Joe has lectured in more than 24 different countries, educating people like you and me about the role and function of the human brain. He has taught thousands how to reprogram their thinking through scientifically proven neurophysiological principles. He shows how thinking in new ways, as well as changing your beliefs, can literally rewire your brain. His most recent best-selling book is You Are the Placebo. Joe has also developed a set of simple tools for triggering these changes. And after using them, many people have reported rapid and radical shifts in old patterns. At the end of the interview, he gives you a brief but potent meditation that guides you into visioning your peak potential, then anchoring it into your body for lasting change down to the level of your cells. When you purchase the upgrade to this program, you'll get the extended play version that includes the meditation. I encourage you to upgrade now so you'll get the version of the interview that includes that closing meditation and the powerful transformation it can produce in both your mind and your body. So, Joe, I'd love to hear a little bit about your own personal healing story and the experiences that brought you to this understanding that we have such incredibly strong innate inner healing powers.
Sure. I mean, I think in order for us to wake up, Dawson, sometimes we need a wake-up call. And in 1986, I got the call. I was in a triathlon in Palm Springs, California, and I was on the biking portion of a race. And I was probably 10 miles into the race, and I was coming up to a corner to make a right-hand turn. And there were two cyclists on the corner, and I was going to pass those two cyclists. And there was a police officer waving me on to make the turn, and he was very animated. So I had my eyes connected to his eyes, and he was waving me on to gesturing to tell me to pass these two bikers. And as I passed these two bikers, there was a four-wheel drive vehicle going about 55 miles an hour that he had his back to. So he was looking at me and not at the traffic. And so when I made the turn past the cyclists, I got catapulted out of my bicycle by this vehicle and landed pretty hard on my butt and my back. And I wound up breaking four vertebrae in my spine. I had multiple compression fractures of my thoracic spine. And when you land in a vertical position, the blocks or the columns of the vertebrae, when they compress, the bone fragments have to go somewhere. And in my case, they went back onto my spinal cord. And one particular vertebrae was more than 60% collapsed. And not only were the bone fragments against my cord, but the arch that contained the cord had broken like a pretzel. So now I had a good amount of cord compression as well. And the prognosis wasn't very good. For the most part, I had four opinions from four of the leading surgeons in Southern California. And they basically told me that I'd probably be confined to a wheelchair or I'd probably never walk again. And they recommended this radical surgery called the Harrington rod surgery. And that's when they cut off the back parts of your vertebrae. And in my case, it would be from the base of my neck to the base of my spine. And then they screw in these stainless steel rods and about 12 inches long. And when they screw them in, what it does is it cantilevers the broken segments and aligns the spine and takes the pressure off the cord. And then they take some bone fragments from your hip and they paste it over the top and they hope for the best. And you know, for me, it was probably a very pivotal point in my life because I think, given my background, if I had seen a patient with this condition and I saw the scans and I saw the x-rays, I probably would have recommended the surgery for any patient, but this was me. And I wasn't so quick to make the decision. And by me not making the immediate conventional decision, it created quite a bit of unrest for the medical community. And after about 4 days of back and forth, I decided to not have the surgery. And I just believed at the time and still do that there's an intelligence within us that, you know, that gives us life. And I was saying to myself during this whole entire time, the power that made the body heals the body. And it just doesn't happen any other way. And so I thought, well, if this intelligence is real and it's giving me life, since I'm not going anywhere or doing anything, you know, basically laying face down and not moving very much, I'm not living my life in the same way, I got a lot of time on my hands, and maybe I'll make an effort to make contact with this intelligence and give it a plan, give it a template, give it a design, and then surrender my creation to this greater mind and allow it to begin to do the healing for me. And the second thing I said, Dawson, was that I wasn't going to let any thought slip by my awareness that I didn't want to experience. Now, that sounds like a really good idea, but...
Easier said than done.
Right. And I learned something really important as a person in my 20s, is that when we're in crisis, we're in trauma, we're in absolute chaos, we tend to focus on what we don't want to have happen instead of what we do want to have happen. And so for the next 6 weeks of my life, I was in utter hell. It was the dark night of the soul for me because I couldn't get my mind to do what I wanted it to do. And so I reasoned that this intelligence is a consciousness, and consciousness is awareness, and awareness is paying attention. So it had to be paying attention to my efforts. And just like when you're present with your partner or your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your husband or your wife or your kids or your coworkers, you know, when you're present, you're paying attention. And so I realized that I had to be completely present with this intelligence if I was going to give it very clear instructions. And so I would start out reconstructing my spine vertebrae per vertebrae, and the next thing you know, I'd be thinking about living in a wheelchair. And then the next thing I do, I'd start off reconstructing my spine again, and then I'd think about, should I sell my practice or my house? And I kept losing my attention in the present moment, and the side effect was is that I get frustrated and impatient. And then I'd have to start all over, and then my frustration would make things worse. And it was a pretty much a dark night of the soul for me, because I was weighing pretty much conventional old paradigms, old beliefs, against new philosophical paradigms and understandings. And crossing that river, for the most part, was really what it took for me to make a very significant change internally. So at the end of about 6 weeks, I remember the day exactly that I had gone through the entire internal process of reconstructing my vertebrae. And I made it through without losing my attention the entire time. And it was like I hit a tennis ball right in the sweet spot. Something clicked. I think I clicked. And from that point forward, things started getting very different. I started to do what took me 3 hours to get through. I was able to get through in under an hour. I was firing and wiring new circuits in my brain, and I was reconditioning my body to a new mind. And it started to become more familiar and easier for me, and my biology started to reflect my very intentions. And so it became a moment where I started noticing some very significant changes in my body. I started feeling better. My pain levels went away. My sensations in my legs had started to change. My motor strength started to alter as well. And the moment I started to notice changes in what was going on outside of me, I started paying attention to what I was doing inside of me. But I did it this time with more enthusiasm and more passion and more excitement, and things started changing even more rapidly. And then I started thinking, well, God, I have so much time on my hands. I'm not going anywhere or doing anything. I might as well start thinking about things that I'd love to do if I was ever able to walk again. And I started thinking about watching a sunset, or sitting at lunch with my friends and eating, or taking a shower. And I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but I was selecting different potentials in the quantum field. And I started to emotionally embrace every single one of those events. And my body, as the unconscious mind, did not know the difference between the actual experience in my life that would be creating the emotion and the emotion that I was fabricating by thought alone. And I began to literally signal new genes in new ways, and my body began to respond to my mind. And from that point forward, things started changing very rapidly. And at about 10 weeks, I was back on my feet. And at 12 weeks, I was living my life just like it never happened again. And during those times where I was awake in the middle of the night, I just made a deal with myself that if I was ever able to walk again, I would spend the rest of my life studying the mind-body connection and how mind affects matter. And for the most part, that's what I've been doing since then.
And I'm sure all the physicians that examined you and that saw you make that miraculous recovery were then completely convinced of the same thing and enthusiastically endorsed it, put all their patients on the same protocol, and made sure that it was the front line of treatment in their hospitals, right?
Well, I can tell you this, that the medical director of Scripps Hospital at the time, who, by the way, was the most credible person that you could ever meet. He was super distinguished. He was handsome. He had the right clothes, the right lab coat. He had the salt and pepper hair, a very firm handshake. He represented my greatest doubt. And when I decided to check out of the hospital that day, he swore that I had post-traumatic stress disorder and that I had hit my head and that I was making the wrong decision. And I called him, you know, after I was back on my feet, and he was stupefied that I was on my feet, and he could not imagine that it was even possible. And so I think anything, you know, when you're talking about something that's miraculous, or, you know, what is the definition of a miracle? It's something that happens outside of convention, you know, social convention, scientific convention, political convention, religious convention even. It's something that happens outside our current beliefs. And when you step out into that unknown, you're going to be considered foolhardy and insane because it challenges people's, paradigms. But I think if you're able to pull it off, you may become a hero or a saint or a mystic or some type of genius. And I think most people in history that, went against convention had to, you face some opposition from some limited minds. And for me personally, it was a real defining moment in my life.
Yes. And again, once you've had that kind of moment and opened up that range of possibilities, you can't ever really go back to the place you were before or to the limited subset of reality that you lived in before.
And it's interesting because that's exactly what happened to me, because I walked back into my life and I couldn't even relate with my friends. I had just been initiated by life, and what was I going to complain about? I had nothing to complain about. I was one of the happiest people I knew at the time. I was just in love with life, and I couldn't relate with even my closest friends at that time. And by the way, you know you're in trouble in your life when you have to make a decision, and your friends pat you on the shoulder and they say, "We know you'll make the right decision," because what that really means is, "I'm so glad I'm not you." You know, and when I had to make that decision, I saw the discomfort in their eyes, and I knew that I was taking a risk. But I started asking some really profound questions, you know, and I'm an analytical, kind of scientifically minded person. And I started asking, like, who am I? You know, what am I doing here? Where am I going? What's the purpose of life? What is this mystical intelligence? And it started me on a journey of really looking for answers. And I retreated from my life for a period of time and started studying quantum physics and neuroscience and neuroendocrinology and epigenetics. And I thought, well, if quantum model says possibilities exist, and that we may be editing out some of reality here, and if subjective mind has an effect on the objective world, what is mind? And maybe we can get better at executing greater levels of mind. And that got me on the journey. And then I got itchy and wanted to see if anybody else had done what I did, and I started studying spontaneous remissions and went to 17 different countries and interviewed people that were diagnosed with chronic and serious debilitating conditions that were treating conventionally and unconventionally and either staying the same or getting worse, and all of a sudden they got better. And I wanted to study what the cause was that was producing the effect, and became overly joyed to find out that these were common people doing the uncommon. So that's when I wrote my first book, you know, Evolve Your Brain, and hopefully was able to explain the neuroscience and biology of how that was possible. And then when the movie What the Bleep came out, that became an overnight sensation. But there were two questions that people asked when we were doing bleep conferences around the world. how do you create the life you want, and why is it so hard to change? And so that's when we started doing the workshops and teaching people the how-to. How do you take these principles and go from philosopher to initiate to master? How do you take philosophical information and apply it, begin to produce some sound experiences, and then be able to replicate those experiences? And so we started teaching workshops, and for the first year, nothing really happened. Now, we didn't see a lot of big changes, but then after the first year, we started seeing some magic happening, and people started sending emails, and their health conditions were changing, and they were creating the opportunities in their life, and some of severe emotional wounds and scars were being lifted, and people's health was reflected in their health. And then I wrote the second book, Breaking the Habit, and that's kind of the how-to. It was a companion. But then things started getting even more crazy, because right during the workshops that we were doing around the world, we started seeing people experience verifiable healings. And I know that you know this because you do the similar work right during our workshops, MS and lupus and chronic pain and just all kinds of eczemas and different conditions disappear like in 4 days. And I knew in that moment that we were signaling new genes in new ways, and that the body was upregulating certain states and downregulating other states genetically. And I knew in that moment that I had to start measuring some of those changes. And then we brought in a team of neuroscientists and physicists and researchers, and we started measuring people's brains. We started measuring their hearts. We started measuring their neurotransmitters in their urine, and the energy fields around their body, and the energy centers of their body, and the energy in the room. And I wanted to quantify it to such a degree that that I demystified the concept to such a point where it was repeatable. And I used really the principles from my first book in studying people who transformed themselves, and then wanted to see if you used it on well people, if you could produce the same results, or on sick people, if it really worked. And I think it's a time in history where it's not enough to know. It's a time in history where people want to know how. And so that's kind of led me on the journey to writing my last book and really, really interested in using science as a contemporary model of mysticism.
Yes, and of course, we have known that these things happen, but now that we have these tools and instruments that can detect those changes, for example, in gene expression or the electromagnetic field around the body, we can actually scientifically measure the shifts and the outcomes for people. And that marks a big change in the explanatory model for what's going on here. We don't have to refer just to, for example, those quantum effects, which might indeed be happening, but they're unmeasurable. But with current equipment, we can, though, measure those really practical things like hormones, neurotransmitters, and energy fields. And it's just very, very powerful in this scientific language of discourse we have in our civilization to be able to give scientific tags to those kinds of rapid healings.
And I think that it's so amazing, because the awareness that's taking place around the world, Dawson, is, and you know this also, is, 10 years ago, people would take a step back, and now it's becoming part of dinner conversation. People are really just understanding that if all of these scientific models, whether it's quantum physics or neuroplasticity or epigenetics or receptor site physiology, and all of these different things that point the finger to possibility truly exist, then if you're thinking the same thoughts, you're making the same choices, you're creating the same behaviors that produce the same experiences, that create the same emotions, then for the most part, your biology is going to stay exactly the same. And that's really when people start to reason and scratch their head, and they start going, well, new thoughts should lead to new choices, and new choices should lead to new behaviors, and new behaviors should create new experiences, and new experiences should create new chemical feedback called emotions, and we should see some evolution here, or my biology should reflect that. And so there's all the evidence that's saying it, and I think part of it is deprogramming ourselves to really begin to believe that it's possible. And of course, belief is an important element in the whole game.
Well, I love the way in your newest book, You Are the Placebo, you riff from stories of people who have had these miraculous experiences, miraculous healings, placebo-driven healings, to the studies and the objective science that supports these kinds of shifts. So if someone wants to hear an inspiring story, they'll get the story. If they're more convinced by the science, they'll get the science. But whether you are moved by story or whether you need to see the hard numbers to convince you, the picture you paint in that book is so compelling. And the way you then move to actually giving us case histories of people who've applied these things and seen rapid and remarkable shifts, even in conditions that are judged to be incurable conventionally, is so amazing. Would you mind just sharing a couple of those stories with us, of those kinds of miraculous healings?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote You Are the Placebo is because it was happening in real time, as I said, and it got me thinking, you know, I mean, if I understood the science and the biology of how the placebo really works, could I begin to demystify it even to a greater degree? So if you give someone a sugar pill or a saline injection, or you perform some sham surgery or false treatment or procedure, a certain percentage of those people will accept, believe, and surrender to the idea that whatever they're doing or taking is a verifiable treatment or a chemical, and they'll begin to heal by thought alone. And as you know, once they begin to accept that thought as reality, then that thought begins to program their autonomic nervous system, and they begin to make their own pharmacy of chemicals that matches the exact external substance that they think they're taking. So then, do you need the external substance to do it, or can you teach people the physiology of how that works and eliminate their belief in something outside of them and put their belief in themselves in a field of potentials and take some unknown concept and keep revisiting it enough times until it begins to become a known phenomenon? And when that occurs, then it really begins to become visceral. It begins to become cellular. And so I know now, just from, first of all, I was more shocked than anybody when I saw certain conditions transform that transcend even the model of the placebo in our workshops and in some of the case histories that we studied, because I think people, once they understood what they were doing and why they were doing it and how to do it, the same model could apply with genetic disorders and the same model can apply with cancers, et cetera, et cetera. So I chose to write the book a little differently, because what I wanted to do is I wanted to challenge people's idea of how programmed they are, number one, and number two, how powerful we really are. And so I start the book off by telling a story of a man who was diagnosed with a certain type of esophageal cancer. He had gone through treatment, and then a little ways past the treatment, he started developing other symptoms. He went to the hospital, and they found out that they did some scans, and they saw that his liver had a positive scan, and so they didn't think he would live too much longer. They told him, look, we can keep you comfortable for a few more months, and he said, I just want to live till Christmas. And so 1 week after Christmas, he dies, and they do an autopsy on his body, and the problem is that they had a false positive test on his liver scan, that he didn't have enough cancer in his liver. Hardly, he had a little small nodule, but not enough to kill him, that in fact, he died by thought alone. So if you start really embracing how powerful our beliefs are and how we move into these conditions biologically, then is it possible then, when people get a diagnosis of a certain condition, just like the voodoo doctor who places a curse on the subject, I mean, is it the same thing when we're given a diagnosis, that we accept, believe, and surrender to that diagnosis without any analysis, and we take the voodoo curse? And so deprogramming is part of it. And, you know, I go through extensive measures in the book to really show, first of all, that so many great stories of the placebo that it's undeniable that a good percentage, between 10% and 100% of different placebo studies are just because of the power of the mind. So we started doing our workshops and using the same principles, and we've seen some elegant and beautiful changes in people. For example, we had one woman who had a polycystic fibrodysplasia, which is a bone-weakening condition, and the very matrix and the scaffolding of the proteins of her bones were decaying, and it was on one side of her body. And when she was a teenager, she was walking around with a limp for a year and found out that she had a fracture in her femur, and the diagnosis came back as a bone wasting disease, and they said it was genetic, and that she would probably live with this condition for the rest of her life, and there was nothing to do except try to structurally put pins in her femur to stabilize it. Well, problem is that when you stabilize that area, you'll wind up with a weakening above and below the pins, and that could cause fractures in other areas. So for years, this woman had dealt with quite a bit of pain. She had 12 fractures in over the course of about a decade. She had to be mobilized with a motorized a wheelchair or crutches or a walker, and the smallest a jolt on her long bones would cause fractures. And the history is that she was raised in a family. Her father was very violent, and she was spent a lot of time in fear. And as you know, when children are very suggestible to their external environment because of their brain waves, and she spent a lot of time feeling vulnerable and weak. And of course, that those experiences over time were just a strong enough amplitude of emotion that it began to program the gene, and she manifested weakness in her bones. I mean, that's the exact manifestation. And of course, then she was vulnerable and she needed special attention. And so she started on the journey in our workshops, and this is not something that happened overnight for her. Just like when someone's in a study, placebo study for depression, and they're taking the placebo, they're taking that pill, whether it's real or not, every single day to remind them of some future possibility, some level of health. And it's that kind of clear intention of selecting possibility combined with the elevated emotion that takes the brain and body out of the past and puts it in the future. And so the body as the unconscious mind begins to change. But it may take 6 or 8 weeks to see the change. And for this woman, because she had been an identity that has identified with her condition, and she had some strong emotions that led to quite a bit of control in her life and quite a bit of fear, that she had to really break free from the chains of her past. And it took her over a year to make these changes, but never did she miss a day from what I would say taking the placebo and moving into a new state of being. And in a very short amount of time, after about a year, I noticed that she was showing up at our workshops and no longer walking with a crutch or crutches or a cane. And then all of a sudden she wasn't walking with anything, and then she had no sign of a limp. And then she got results back a little bit later on that there wasn't even evidence of any fracture in her long bone. It looked like she had never had any fractures in there. But her blood values were still showing, the markers still showed the disease. But I kept telling her, your body lives in the past. Don't worry about it. Just keep crossing that river of change. Just keep going. And I learned something really valuable in reading so many of these testimonials, Dawson. And I think it's so amazing that it took me this long to figure it out. But I noticed that many people that heal themselves, they reach a point of such self-satisfaction, in such a place of wholeness. They feel so complete and happy with themselves that they no longer care if they even have the disease any longer. And the moment they get to that point, that's the moment that disease disappears. And that's exactly what happened to her. She went to our physician in New York City. She had the values of blood drawn, the urine taken, and she was just thankful to be alive. And she walked out of there, and she got a call 2 weeks later, and they told her she was completely normal, and there's no evidence any longer of any disease in her body. I mean, she's a new personality, and a new personality creates a new personal reality. Disease exists in the old personality, not in the new personality. She's literally somebody else. And so I tell those stories in a way that hopefully show people that it could happen in a moment, or it may take an amplitude of energy every single day that is greater than their past, that begins to knock on the genetic door, that finally signals the right gene in the right way. And so there's a reality to it that it could happen over time, it could happen immediately, or it could even take an extended period of time. But I think that when people begin to understand that, I think they can keep one foot in the real world and one foot in the quantum world.
You mentioned a couple of times the importance of elevated emotion. Why is that so important?
Well, I think, you know, if you define emotion for most of us, you know, most people can relate with anger and aggression and frustration and hatred and hostility and judgment and envy and jealousy and insecurity and fear and anxiety and depression, hopelessness, powerlessness. Those are what, you know, psychologists call normal states of consciousness. As you know, those are altered states of consciousness, and they're derived primarily by the stress hormones. And you know, from a quantum perspective, stress hormones cause us to be materialists. We define reality by our senses, and we are, for the most part, more matter and less energy. We're functioning as matter, trying to change matter, and that doesn't work very well. So then we have to use our limited resources of competition and manipulation and being cunning and deceitful, whatever we can to get what we want, because we're matter trying to change matter. But when we measured the effects of a clear intention and an elevated emotion, a clear intention now is a vision of a future. That's a mindful process. And an elevated emotion is celebrating the event before it occurs. In other words, you give gratitude. Gratitude, the emotional signature of gratitude, means the event has already happened or the event is happening to you in that moment. And so if you combine that clear intention with an elevated emotion, a few things happen. A person's body, as their unconscious mind, begins to believe it's in that future experience in the present moment, and the body begins to physiologically change. The second thing that happens is when we open up our hearts, truly open up our hearts, we feel connected to something greater, and we feel more like energy and less like matter. And energy is the epiphenomenon of matter, which means we have more effects in executing change in matter. And then the other thing is that when we open our hearts and we trust in an outcome, we have to lay down the very thing we used our whole life to get what we want for something greater to occur. And that begins the process of surrender. And the surrender then means then you are living as if it has already happened. And that's an easy thing to talk about. But if you get a group of people retreating from their life for a period of time and you can work them up into the state, that's absolutely, without a doubt, when the miraculous begins to happen. So I think a clear intention and elevated emotion moves us from living in the past and defining ourselves by our past to defining ourselves as a vision of the future. And that's when we begin to move into what I call a state of being. Because thoughts are the language of the brain and feelings are the language of the body. And how we think and how we feel creates a state of being. And that's the quantum field. And this consciousness, this innate intelligence, tends to endorse and respond to our being. So if we can maintain those states of being for a period of time, we should see some physiological responses. And I can honestly say now, I believe that it's truly the way it happens.
Do you think the effect is more pronounced when these intentions are held, or these possibilities are embraced, or these feelings are felt in a group? Is there something that lends more energy to the process when it's done in the context of a group?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. I mean, we've measured the energy in the room and a few of our advanced events, and I can tell you that, you know, everybody talks about, oh, the energy is really great in the room. Well, I wanted to measure that. And if you get enough people who are going from particle to wave, from matter to energy, and they're creating coherent heart patterns and coherent brainwave patterns, that's a very strong amplitude of energy. And that what that creates, and we've seen this with, I mean, people with traumatic brain injuries and anxiety, your nervous system is your superconductor of the field. And so when people are able to tune in, there's just more available energy, and everybody's contributing to it, and it's enhancing. It's creating that simultaneous field effect. So we did a few experiments in the last couple of advanced workshops, and we had people open their hearts, and right at the exact same time, in about 20 different people, I looked at all of the exact time, 20 different people went into heart coherence, at the same exact time, in the same exact meditation, and created the same physiological state. And I think that there's an entrainment process that happens. And the same thing happens with brain coherence. When a person is opening their focus and they're getting beyond the boundaries of focusing on objects and particles and things to focusing on space, that's the moment the brain tends to recalibrate. And where you place your attention is where you place your energy. So if you're placing your attention on the energy field around your body, then you're enhancing that field, and that begins to contribute to the whole. And so now there's a more of a resource, more of a pool of energy to draw from, because it's no longer latent, it's way more activated. And we measured the energy in the room, and both times, one time it doubled and one time it tripled. So we now know that now there's available energy for us to access, and I think a group setting is a great way to really experiment.
Fascinating. So as we are discovering more and more about this process, as we're building up evidence, as we're seeing client and patient outcomes, as we're building up the store of case histories, as we're plotting the various shifts that occur both in physiology and in emotional states, now that we're building up this picture, how do you see us really starting to harness these phenomena most efficiently for personal change? Because if we know they're happening, we know they're possible, we may as well become as efficient as possible at harnessing them for our own healing and our own growth.
Hmm. Well, this is a great conversation, because I think most people wait for crisis or trauma or disease or diagnosis or loss really to make the decision to change. You know, we have to be brought to our lowest denominator before we get serious about transformation. And I think that's because we don't longer feel like ourselves, and because we don't feel like ourselves, we can see ourselves. But in actuality, my message is, why wait? You know, you can learn and change in a state of pain and suffering, or you can learn and change in a state of joy and inspiration. And I think, speaking from my present state of ignorance, of course, that when you see someone dance the salsa well, you'll dance the salsa better. If you see someone hit a tennis ball with a certain amount of skill and you watch them and you play tennis, you'll hit a tennis ball better. If you see someone lead with courage and compassion in their life, you'll lead with courage and compassion in your life. And if you see someone stand up on a stage and talk about how their husband committed suicide and left them with their children, and they developed paralysis and then esophageal sores and mucous membrane lesions, and then develop esophageal cancer, and then tell the story about over the course of a year, turn that disease around and heal themselves, and you listen to the story in detail, you're more prone to accept, believe, and surrender without any analysis that it's possible for you. And that's because of mirror neurons. We learn by observation. We learn by example. So I think it's a really amazing idea that if people really wrap their mind around this and really start to embrace it and they really start to try it out, that nobody is so special to be excluded from this phenomenon, and that maybe, just maybe, when we start tapping in to the innate resources that we have, and you find out how powerful you are, and that you don't have to live by a story of your past, and you can begin the journey, I think you'll see very, very simply common people beginning to do the uncommon. And because we're in an age of information, that information is so readily available, so many different paradigms are beginning to break down, whether it's the medical model, the political model, the economic model, whether it's the environment, the religious model, the educational, it's all beginning to collapse, because people can become an expert because information is so readily available because of technology. And so people are informed. And because they're informed, I think they want a greater sense of understanding about how to apply these concepts. And it's just a pregnant time in history. And I think that the answer is that we have to demonstrate this, we have to show how possible it is, and we have to show people that if they just took the time and made an effort, it could become a skill. And once it becomes a skill, it's repeatable, and anything that's repeatable is science. So hopefully that's the model that we'll walk into one day soon.
Yeah, you know, one of the ways in which I was completely wrong, I've had several junctures along the way in which I've had discussions with people taking positions which were completely erroneous. And Joe, in the late 1980s, I remember talking to somebody, I think it may have been David Feinstein or Norm Shealy, and really believing and being convinced that the kinds of miraculous energy healings I had seen were due to the skill of the energy healers. And of course, we knew these stories from the 80s and 70s of these talented people. In fact, Norm Shealy wrote a whole book about this called Sacred Healing, about these gifted individuals that, one, for example, that worked in North Carolina, specialized in cancer, and people would come and see him. He'd work on their tumors, the tumors would disappear. I was convinced that those were remarkable healings, and that only that guy could do them, that they were non-transferable. But I was shown to be wrong, because now, of course, we have the Barbara Brennan School of Healing, we have Donna Eden's School of Energy Healing, we have EFT Universe teaching EFT, we have all of these ways of training people to do this, and we're finding that many people are able to replicate these results, even those that thought they were not energy sensitive, didn't have the abilities, didn't have the skills. We're discovering that they are teachable skills, not just esoteric gifts that only some people have while the whole bulk of the population is passed by.
Oh, of course. I mean, and the beauty behind that is that people are wanting that information, and they want to know that they are in a partnership with the healer and the person who's receiving, that there is an elegant and refined partnership between the two, and they're bringing out an innate aspect of them that's dormant. And so it requires both interchanges of information for it to happen to such a fine level. And there is a skill involved, but there is also a person's acceptance in how it all unfolds as well.
So you believe both of those things need to be there?
I do. I think there's no direct formula. I mean, I know that just from my own personal practice that I have plenty of times where I have people that really aren't sure whether it's going to work. But my energy is very clear, and I have a lot of experience, and I know that I can help them. And so there are times when I think the practitioner's skill set will be greater than the person's analytical or limited understanding. And there's other times when, there is a person who really has let go and surrendered to such a degree that they're putting their anticipation and expectation of the outcome in such a coherent way that it only takes a small nudge and it produces a large effect as well.
So as people are inspired to a higher vision of who they might be, that healed vision of who they might be, and as they begin to, in the wonderful title of your previous book, as they begin to break the habit of being themselves, how many steps along that journey do you need to be able to visualize, see, and powerfully imagine? Do you need to have the final result clearly in mind? Is just, say, if you're severely limited, just one small step past your current limitation, is that enough? How far in the future along the healing journey do you have to be able to see for this process to begin to work?
I think when people are sick, one of the biggest challenges with, say, for example, what we're talking about in terms of disease, is that the hardest part when there's a chronic condition is to think greater than how we feel. And when feelings become the means of thinking, and feelings are a record of the past, I think one of the hardest challenges is for people to get beyond the past. And so that process, the unlearning process, change takes unlearning and relearning. It requires breaking the habit of the old self and reinventing a new self. It's pruning synaptic connections and sprouting new connections. It's unmemorizing emotions that are stored in the body and then reconditioning the body to a new mind and to a new emotion, deprogramming and reprogram. And so that process of getting beyond the old self, that challenge of not doing the same thing unconsciously, since that's the majority of who we are by the time we're 35 years old, for some people, the intention in changing their state of being, married with the elevated emotion, it's so important for them to become familiar with that state, doing it enough times that they're able to change their state on command. It becomes a skill. And then be greater than the conditions in their environment, and to be greater than the addictions and habituations of the body, and then be able to sustain that internal regulated state for an extended period of time. That's really the art. And so I'm not so concerned about a person having such a vision that keeps them alive for a period of time in the future. I think it's about maintaining a modified state of mind and body for an extended period of time, because that's really when you move into a new state of being that your physiology sooner or later begins to respond. So we do a lot of work in our advanced events where we teach people how to signal new genes in new ways, into how to recondition the body to a new mind, and how to get beyond their identity and to create more coherent states in their heart and in their brain. All of that is to regulate what we call a whole brain state, or a coherent state of being. And that's the funny thing happens when this occurs, that when a person finally lands there, all the things that they thought they wanted, they no longer want. Because they feel so whole and complete, they can't want, because the moment they want, they go into lack. And so there's a kind of a paradox that takes place. Because if you believe in the quantum model of reality, of instead of the Newtonian model of cause and effect, waiting for something outside of you to change how you feel inside of you, and the moment you feel differently inside of you, you pay attention to whoever or whatever caused it outside of you. And that event, of course, is called a memory. That's cause and effect. You know, you wait for your new lover to show up to be happy. You wait for your wealth to appear to feel abundant. You know, you wait for the new opportunity and job in order for you to feel gratitude. You know, that's the old model of reality. But the quantum model of reality about causing and effect then is that then if you want a healing, you have to feel wholeness before the healing. If you want a great relationship, you have to feel love before that relationship. If you truly want abundance, if that's what you are, then you have to feel free and abundant before the experience. And if you want a mystical moment, you have to be in awe with life before it occurs. And so then when people start to realize, if I'm going to be successful, why am I wanting success? Because I want to feel empowered. Well, then your job is to teach your body emotionally what that empowerment is going to feel like before the actual event, so your brain and body begin to physically change, so that you're no longer in the past. Now, your brain and body have already experienced it enough times that the side effect is called knowingness. And so I think that it's important to teach people how to move into states of being. And every day, if they can move into a state of being, they are taking a placebo in a certain sense, and then being greater than the conditions in our environment, and being able to maintain that modified state of mind and body begins to allow the uncommon to happen in our life. And when the uncommon starts to happen, and it happens in a way that we least expect, we begin to develop a neurological network that it's entirely possible that we, as simple human beings, can do the miraculous and the uncommon. I think that we start focusing on so many material things, and we start focusing on this concept of giving and taking care of one another. We go from selfish to selfless. We start really considering the whole when we make decisions, and empathy and compassion and true trust and joy and forgiveness is something that is a side effect of you feeling so great and so whole that it's impossible to judge, because the moment you judge, you would lose that feeling, and you wouldn't want to trade that feeling for anyone and any or anything. And so people are waking up to that, because we've seen it happen in our workshops where we were measuring 10 times the amplitude in people's brains during certain meditations. Now, they couldn't make their brain do that. It was happening to them. And the inner experience was so profound that it was greater than any past experience. And when their chemistry changed to that degree, because it was reflected in the circuitry in their brain, all they wanted to do was they wanted to give. They said, I feel so amazing, I want everybody to feel the way I do. And they couldn't hold a grudge any longer, because it was impossible in that moment. They couldn't look at their past and judge themselves, because that their past got them to this moment, and it was all worth it. And that's, I think, when we start really getting beyond our, you know, our limitations, and we start creating a species that's really cooperative instead of competitive.
So just imagine, as we dream about this, of the possibilities that might occur if people began to function in this way on a large scale. Imagine if school children had this ability to transcend their limitations. Imagine if people who were not sick were using these tools proactively to shape their lives. Imagine if people who were sick had these tools at the disposal and then used them routinely as part of their healing journey, and people who were functioning really well already used them to elevate their level of function even further. Imagine a world like that, Joe, where these things really catch on. And of course, that's why you are doing what you're doing, why I'm doing what I'm doing. We do see that possibility of change. What then starts to happen when this starts to become the new normal, what people are trained to do and start to do on a large scale?
Well, I love the concept in biology called emergence. You know, emergence is a really cool principle. If you ever see a school of fish all turning in the same direction, or you see a flock of birds all flying in a certain pattern, in a certain order, or even neurons in the brain, they all kind of systematically function in coherence. When you see that, just say the school of fish, if you study that phenomenon in biology, you would think that there's some leader that everybody else is following, like it's a top-down phenomenon. But in actuality, it turns out it's a bottom-up phenomenon. There is no leader. In fact, everybody's leading at the same time, that they are connected in one level of consciousness, in one mind, and they're acting as a whole, as a group in coherence. So there's a stigma that we have that if you lead with too much passion, if you lead with too much courage, if you're too much of an individual, you're probably going to get assassinated in the end. I don't care. If you think about it, you can think of Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, William Wallace, Gandhi, Joan of Arc, John Lennon, Jesus of Nazareth. You always get it in the end that you lead with too much passion, and there's a subconscious understanding that you're probably going to be assassinated. So everybody contracts when it comes to individuality. But what if everybody's leading at the same time? It's impossible to take out a culture that's emerging as a new consciousness. And I honestly believe that that's what's going to happen very shortly here, that if enough individuals begin to make their own internal changes and they overcome their own self-imposed limitations, and if you're working on your anger and your frustration, and I'm working on my fear and anxiety, and I'm truly breaking free from the chains that keep me anchored to the past, and my body is now in the present moment, and my heart is open, and I'm seeing through the illusions that keep us distracted and seduced, I think that a new consciousness will emerge in the present consciousness. A new community will outgrow the present culture, and I think that that's what this new consciousness that everybody's talking about means. It means that that if, in order for us to sustain ourselves in the future, that we can't go on competing and murdering and warring and being hostile and deceiving. That's why the end is happening right now. So I honestly believe, and I firmly have seen in just my limited experience, that people truly are good-natured. They really want to make a difference. They want to leave a legacy. They want to contribute to the whole. But if you keep them distracted in fear, and you keep news really bad, and you keep it about competition and materialism and all that stuff, there's quite a bit of deprogramming that has to go on. And I think that what is taking place right now is that people want to become deprogrammed. And when I wrote You Are the Placebo, I think one of the biggest things that I realized when I finished the book is how programmed I really am into certain subconscious and unconscious beliefs that I didn't even know that I was agreeing to. And I think on certain levels, we all do that. So do we really need a flu shot during flu season, or is that just some type of propaganda to keep people living in a certain degree of limitation? Do we believe in germs as a real reason for disease and sickness? And you know, what is our definition of God, and what are we dependent on, and what is our identity? Do we have to look a certain way? And so I think that this is a great time in history where a new consciousness can emerge. And I think the best way that it does emerge is by example. So if we begin to demonstrate that we're no longer knee-jerking in the same way, I mean, how do we become supernatural? The first thing we have to do is start doing what's unnatural. So that means to give when everybody else is taking or in poverty. That means to demonstrate courage and invincibility when everybody else is in fear. It means to truly and clearly have the passion really to show compassion and love when everybody else is judging and fighting. It's to do those unnatural things enough times until we do become supernatural. And that's when I think the world will begin to catch on.
Wow. What a compelling vision, and what a wonderful rationale for applying this in our lives. So, Joe, in closing, two questions. One is, what are some of the practices that you personally do yourself and advocate most strongly to get this process moving in our lives in a practical sense?
Sure. Sure, I'd love to finish with that because I'm a pragmatist and I'm a very practical person. And I think that if we asked ourselves every morning when we woke up in the morning, before we got up and presented ourselves to the world, the simple question, and that is, what is the greatest ideal that I can present myself as today? And as we became, if 95% of who we are is a set of subconscious and unconscious programs of thoughts and behaviors and emotional reactions, if we became conscious of our unconscious thoughts and we became aware of our automatic habits and became less limited, and we became so familiar with and so conscious of those unconscious states, that's the moment where we're no longer the old self. That's the moment we're Gandalf on the bridge saying, you may not pass today. Now, that moment of deciding who you no longer want to be, or reminding yourself of who you no longer want to be, is an important element because that's what stops you from going unconscious in your waking day. Now, if you said to yourself, who do I want to be when I open my eyes? What thoughts do I want to fire and wire in my brain? What behaviors do I want to demonstrate? And you begin to mentally rehearse your behaviors. If you did it properly, your brain would not know the difference between the experience in your outer world and what you were rehearsing mentally. And you would begin to install the neurological circuits and prime your brain to no longer be in the past, but now to be in the future. And if you said to yourself, I'm going to teach my body emotionally what it feels like. I'm going to train it to feel gratitude, to be in love with life, to have a joy for existence, to understand true presence and compassion. I'm going to teach it what it means to know what it is to have all my needs met. And I'm going to get up in a new state of being. I'm not going to get up from my meditation until I am this person. And as you begin to remind yourself of who you no longer want to be, and you remind yourself of who you do want to be, if you practice that every day, sooner or later, it will begin to become familiar to you. And that is the exact definition of the word meditation. The word meditation means to become familiar with. As you become familiar with the old self, so you never go unconscious, and then you create a new self until it becomes familiar. And then you get up from your meditation and maintain that modified state of mind and body your entire day. See your life as your initiation, to challenge you to greatness, not be a victim, but to challenge you to greatness and to meet your life from a new level of mind, a new state of being every day. If you're able to maintain that modified state of mind and body your entire day, get ready, because something unusual will happen in your life. That's the law. And so our job then is to really to move into these states every single day and be a work in progress. And the hardest part of all of this is making the time to do it, making time for our precious selves to really be a work in progress and to continue to modify our states of mind and body to do a better job in life. And I think if we all practice that on some level, we would not only be mystified by our own power internally, but we would start really wanting to make a difference in other people's lives as well.
I think, too, as you do it, there's a phenomenon which I call the epigenetic health cycle. You do it, you feel better, you feel better in your body, you feel healthier, you're happier, and that is a powerful inducement to do more of it. You do more of it, you feel better. Life gives you challenges, maybe you feel a little bit worse one day, but you are on this upward spiral in which it's a self-reinforcing virtuous cycle in which you're encouraged to do more and more and more. So starting to do it, just taking the first steps on the path, I think, can be very powerful in advancing us on the path further. Joe, I wonder if to end with, you could just maybe take us to that state in a practical sense for a few moments.
Okay, well, if you just took a moment and took your left hand and placed it over your heart, and you became aware of your breathing, just how your body draws oxygen in, and then how it lets it out, and how you become present in the generous present moment, and you begin to become conscious of who you want to be when you open your eyes. And you think about a greater sense of giving, a greater level of awareness, a more complete sense of joy. And you think about how you'll demonstrate it in your work, in your family life, how you can be when you walk, when you move, when you breathe in your daily living, everyday existence. And then can you move into a new state of being and allow your body to begin to respond to your mind? And if you could for one moment change your energy and to teach your body emotionally what it feels like to be in this future, what would invincibility feel like? What would strength feel like? What would passion feel like? What would love feel like? And if you could memorize this feeling for one moment, and begin to broadcast a new signature into the field for whatever you broadcast into the field is your experiment with life. And if you can remember this feeling at different points in your day and return back to this energy, the longer you linger in this energy, the more you draw opportunity to you. And one more breath. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes.
Wow, I felt I went to a profoundly different space. And oddly enough, I was, although emotionally it felt incredibly deep and calming, it was also so mentally aware that in the middle, I opened my eyes and just wrote on a title for this meditation without leaving that emotional, delicious emotional state. And Joe, this is the title of your meditation, is Broadcasting a New Signal into the Field, a New Version of You into the Field.
Oh, I love it. That's exactly what it is.
So I want to encourage all of our listeners to do this every day. Make this part of your routine, that rather than starting your day with that same version of yourself that has kept you unhappy and limited for so long, go ahead and play this section of the interview again, and then spend time not just having that vision, not just considering that new version of you, but considering the highest possible version of you. What is the version of you? What is the thought of you the universe is thinking right now? What is the highest version of you the universe is conceiving of right now? Stay in that space. Think that thought. Flesh it out with as much vivid detail as possible. And this method Joe had us do of putting our hands over our heart, that anchors in our bodies. It's no longer an abstract thought in our heads that's just out there intellectually. It's anchoring us in the felt sense of that as a real possibility. So that may seem like a very simple gesture to put your hand over your heart. It's a profound gesture because it hooks up that thought, that imagination of greater possibility with your body, your feelings, and the physical world you live in your cells. And when you do that, that's when you unlock the full extent of this magic. So it's well worth doing this, practicing it just the way Joe did when he was healing from that terrible injury all those years ago. You can start to embody this highest possible version of you. And when you do this, I can tell you, Joe will tell you, I will tell you from my own experience, that you will find absolutely remarkable things start to happen in what seems to be out there, the world out there. All kinds of things start to shift out there when the universe starts to think its highest thought of you through you in the material body.
Absolutely. Very well said, Dawson.
My brother, I so appreciate you, and I so thank you for your work. I've been moved by it, blessed by it, challenged by it on occasion, and I'm just so thrilled to see so many people appreciating it and applying it in their lives and seeing the effects rippling out from where they stand.
Well, excellent, and I totally appreciate everything that you do, and am a big fan and admire your work and how you're contributing to the world, and it's inspiring me also.
Well, thanks again so much.
You're welcome.